Gurave Gaurachandraya Radhikaya Tadale Krishnaya Krishna Bhaktaya Tad Bhaktaya Namo Namah. So, pranam to all of you. Welcome again. Thank you so much for your presence and time and attention and sincere inquiry and interest in this case, what Mahaprabhu is trying to give us, his gift, in this case, in the form of Shikshastakam, on the third verse of Shikshastakam, the golden rule of the golden Lord, giving us a golden opportunity to embrace. So everything is golden if we have the eyes to see. So today we are in our second meeting in connection to our study of this third verse. In between, we've had a few Q&A, question explorations on other topics. We're now back to our main theme. In our first gathering, we gave a little bit of an introduction, locating this third verse in somehow scriptural, historical context, how the Shikshastakam comes to become the Shikshastakam, and so on and so forth. We mentioned how this verse is mentioned three times in Chaitanya Charitamrita more than any other verse, like making a point with that, making an emphasis on the importance of it. And we also mentioned the importance of this verse as a, if you will, preliminary things to have in place before we aspire to full absorption in bhakti, no? Because this verse teaches us, among other things, how to relate to each other. Not only how to relate to Krishna, how to relate to each other. And if that's not in place, sometimes spiritual life can be even spiritual bypassing, right? So we are put to test in our relationships. Let's put it that way, right? So skipping this verse or skipping the proper way to relate to everything can be harmful if we just go to spiritual life as an avoidance of unresolved stuff in how we relate to others. So, and in that context, maybe you recall we shared a few verses from the Bhagavatam on Kapiladev. Remember, he was talking about Archanam and very strong words about, okay, if you worship the deity but mistreat other people, but do not see God in other people, that worship is basically useless, in his words. Not like implying our relationship with God has to be reflected in our relationship with everyone else, not only with the Gaudiya Vaishnava community, with everyone else, with everything else. So how we relate to others shows my love to Krishna. How I relate to Krishna shows my love to others. It's interrelated. We are all interconnected. So you cannot put Krishna in one box and everything else in another box. Everything is tied, bonded with this center. So this verse also, we mentioned how this verse represents the nishtha, the state of fixity, stability in bhakti. And I like to refer to this verse as also presenting another set of four regulative principles, right? So nichena, sahishnuna, amanina, manadena. That's another layer or level of conceiving or speaking in terms of four regulative principles. And also we share some little homework that I forgot to share in the class, so Ramchandra shared with you, like trying to extend the lesson and the meditation throughout our day and try to reflect and process, ruminate more on these teachings. So starting from today, we will try to unpack each one of the lines of the verse, each one of the main attributes mentioned there. And as I told you, I think yesterday, I thought I will do all that in one class today, but that will be too much. And we will not do injustice to this verse. So I will take a few more meetings today in the morning, tomorrow in the evening. I already make the schedule, so no problem, Ramachandra, everything is in place. I will also have one other Q&A in a few days. I will spend some five gatherings trying to properly honor this verse. And of course, we will be addressing the different lines and qualities, but at the same time, I'd like to make the point that in one sense, these four pillars or these four regulative principles, humility, tolerance, modesty, respect, somehow are interrelated, no? you cannot be extremely humble and absolutely intolerant, right? You cannot be offering respect to others but not being humble. So in one sense, we could even make a case for actually all these four things is one thing, no? Express and conceive from different angles, but you cannot have one without the other in one sense, if you really play out the implications of that. So I wanted just to make that point. And yeah, I'm trying to spend some time with this verse. I always like this system of reading, if you want, or study. They have in mystical Christianity called Lectio Divina. Maybe you've heard about Lectio. That. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what they will do is they will just read the scripture and they find one line that struck them. So they will stop reading and they will take that line and try to think, okay, why this is striking me? Why it's impacting me? What's the lesson here? And try to reflect as much as we can. And when we have reached out the limit of our capacities, then they start to pray to God for further insight on that particular line. And then after the praying comes the silence, moment of silence to hear, to listen to God's reply to our prayer. And then how to apply this into my life. And then, okay, then we can move forward to the next part of the book. It's a more type of contemplative reading, but it can be naturally applied to anything. So we are doing this with this verse. It's not like, okay, we can read this verse in less than a minute. I will spend five gatherings of a few hours to stay with it, ruminate, and try to see what it has to tell us. So again, the verse, which has been beautifully carved and portrayed here by Ramachandraji today, Trinadapi Sunichina Tadorapi Sahishnuna Amaninama Nadina Kirtaniya Sadahari. And the poetic rendition we are sharing these days with you says, be as humble as the quiet grass, as enduring as the ancient tree. Seek not the praise of man, but honor every soul you see. With this heart, sing the name of Hari endlessly. So let's begin with the first line. Today we will concentrate on Trinadapi Sunichena. And as you will see, there's so much to say about this. So there are three words, but I think it's important to this exercise. Okay, let's just to concentrate and flesh out all that these three words have. And not all, just something, but there's so much there. So of course, Trinadapi Sunichena may be as humble as the quiet grass or as the blade of grass. So stay a few seconds with that line in your heart. Be as humble as the blade of grass, or be as humble as the quiet grass. Where to start? As we're saying these days, sometimes, unfortunately, some of these beautiful, sacred, ancient teachings are misrepresented, misunderstood, or even misused. Sometimes the name of humility, we end up demanding a type of toxic submission and reinforcing trauma instead of healing. Or in the names of tolerance, we are just facilitating abuse, and you have to tolerate, just be tolerant. So I'm thinking, like, as a little bit of a therapeutic approach to the whole thing, let's begin. We will say what's humility, but let's begin by exploring what humility is not, what healthy humility is not. That sometimes may be the main reference we may have received from certain people at certain times, from our own selves. Yeah, not to blame anyone, just to normalize that sometimes the thing happens. So again, how to this is called in Latin via negativa, explaining what something is by first saying what something is not. Like Krishna the Bhagavad Gita saying, the soul cannot die, cannot be burned, cannot and not, no, does not, is not born, is not this. No. And then he says something, as we say the other day, about positive about the soul. You are wonderful. The soul is amazing. Right? So in one sense, starting with this via negativa, what healthy humility is not, is a way of deconstructing, dismantling misconceptions, misperceptions that we may have in connection to humility, and we will apply the same criterion to the other qualities before saying what that is, what is not. So I need all of you here now. So what healthy humility is not? What will you say? We can do brainstorming. Yes.
From the end of the verse,
yes,
I would say that healthy humility is not expecting respect or honor from others.
Okay. Healthy humility is not expecting.
Yes.
Yeah, but I'm asking what healthy humility is not. Well, it's okay. I get the point. That was tricky. That was tricky, right?
I didn't mean to be tricky.
No. It's okay. It's accurate. I cannot argue with that. That one on the proof. That was a good one. Yes.
I mentioned that because it's a big one for me.
It's a big one for me. I think we are all in this together. So, yeah. Thank you. Ramachandra, you raise your hand first. We will go through everyone. Yes. So, I mean, you don't need to raise your hand. You can just, yeah.
Healthy humility is not low self-esteem.
Good.
Sorry. Healthy humility is not feeling you have to please other people.
Good. Not a people pleaser, not self-deprecation, low self-esteem, bringing the whip. Trivikram Prabhu, what is...
It's not being a doormat.
It's not being a doormat. What else? It's not, I don't know, false modesty or timidity, you say in English? Timidity? That's not necessarily humility, right? Shyness. It's not necessarily humility.
It's not trying to look humble. It's not trying to look really humble.
Yeah.
Look the part.
Yeah. It's not a competition about who is more humble than everyone else. No, I have to be more humble than you. Yes.
Healthy humility is not speaking the truth.
Good. Thank you. It's not healthy humility is not speaking the truth. I don't want to miss one word here. Yes. What else? Healthy humility is not having a martyr complex. So to say. Something else that came. I mean, we have a lot there on the table. But
not codependency.
Okay. Healthy humility has nothing to do with codependency. Mm-hmm.
It's not giving up my own power of reason and taking responsibility and sort of giving that to somebody else.
Mm-hmm. It's not about being disempowered. Healthy humility should be about empowerment, right? Yeah. Okay, yes, Trivikram Prabhu.
It's not necessarily being non-aggressive either.
Mm-hmm. In some not necessarily being non-aggressive. Mm-hmm. In other words, in some particular cases,
yeah,
we may need to take strong stance to defend, to protect, to whatever. And that will be a commitment to the truth, and that will be humility in its own way, taking a very unique shape, right? Okay.
It's not being arrogant.
It's not being arrogant, okay. Okay, I think we have a good brainstorming. We have to do something with that now. So with all this, we start to have a hint of what real humility looks like. But it helps, I think, for me to go to the what is not. So we can discard. Many times in life, sometimes I hear devotees saying, I don't know what to do with my life, which is my vocation. I'm overwhelmed. Where to go. So I generally say, okay, start with which vocation you definitely won't choose at all. So start with something, okay, I don't want to be a policeman, so to say. No, with all respect, someone is a policeman. You start to have some clarity by saying what you don't want to be, and gradually that helps too. So, and of course, in connection to what we were mentioning, there are different ways that if we have a wrong idea on humility, we can use an external form of humility to avoid the inner substance of humility, right? Like you can use an external form of surrender, like a facade, to actually not be surrendered in the real way that we need to be. Mm-hmm. So going to ask you a few examples on that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Similar to what you said, like empty rituals.
Okay.
Like you're saying, it's showing
yeah
humble behavior, but actually not a humble heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and it's very tempting, I mean, even unconsciously, to resort to the packaging of humility, but the box is empty, so to say, right? So can you think of situations where we resort to this false humility to actually not being humble? Again, even unconsciously, no? I'm not saying you are doing that on purpose. For me, something that comes to mind is, for example, over-apologizing to seem humble, to look humble. Or sometimes, I don't know, avoid taking certain stance in the name of being humble or being fallen, but you are actually avoid taking responsibility. Some other thoughts that come to mind?
Yes, not being assertive.
Mm-hmm.
True, I mentioned the opposite mm-hmm. of that.
Yeah, yeah, not being assertive.
Not speaking out, just in case someone might not like what I say.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In one sense, being a people pleaser.
Yeah. We are from different angles and different words trying to address, yeah. What else? Maybe excessive self-criticism to somehow elicit sympathy. Yeah.
Victim.
Yeah. Somehow connect to being a victim, playing the victim. Mm-hmm.
Just feeling like you have to do everything that you're told to do
mm-hmm.
without any discrimination.
Mm. And many times doing that to avoid confrontation, right? Agreeing with everyone. Again, people, please, to avoid potential confrontation. Not because we want confrontation, but sometimes it comes. You know?
I'm just trying to understand, like, a lot of what we're talking about is reflecting what the social dynamics might be. So socially, to keep some sense of harmony and dealings, then you do adopt certain ways of interacting, certain ways of supporting people, just to keep, you know, the kind of social dynamic more healthy. So I'm just trying to understand where you kind of draw the line of being, because if everybody decided to be straightforward and honest, then my perception of a situation might be one thing and somebody's perception of another. So mm-hmm. But I'm understanding that you're wanting to take us deeper into the sense of humility so we can chant the holy name, but I'm just trying to understand before we go there how do we play that out in social dynamics, because everybody can't walk, it's like, you know, if you're in a classroom or, you know, this, you can't walk around kind of telling each other what to do in a family or...
No, yeah.
And so, yeah, just trying to understand where would you kind of compensate? Do you know what I'm saying?
The last part, compensate, in which sense?
Where would you kind of compensate for the fact that maybe this is not the... you know, maybe say a situation where you're kind of going along with something because it's somebody else's kind of desire and it's their, you know, it's the way that they keep saying and you know, yeah, it's the way they can operate. So
modality.
You kind of
their modality.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's subjective kind of evaluation of each situation
mm-hmm.
in order to give the best result ultimately for each person is actually being humble, because apparently you're not being straightforward in one sense. I mean, that's the whole idea of diplomacy, but you know, we're all dealing with children, for example. You have to pacify their emotional state rather than having to be absolutely right about something necessarily, because you know that ultimately they're on a journey and the journey is going to ultimately culminate, and hopefully it's done in a healthy way, in some mature growth that will enable them to take proper responsibility for the entirety of a situation, which means ultimately understanding the position.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, following on from that, I think everything has to be underscored by our sambandha, really, at the end of the day, that we have an eternal relationship with Krishna. So if we know where we are on the map with that, then we know where we're going to from there. So that's, in a sense, that's kind of, you know, I'm losing my train of thought. My brain's going to sleep.
Well, sorry, maybe I've just brought it too down. Maybe I've brought just the whole thing down too much, because
I think I will say, if I got it correctly, you mentioned that first, Sumukhi, about humility is, humility is not, what did you say at the beginning?
Not speaking the truth.
Okay, so that's for me the main point. And of course, sometimes not you cannot speak the truth, in the sense that for some people, if you say the truth, it's too much. Mm. But it doesn't mean that you are not speaking the truth. You know what's the truth, and you are trying to deal with the other person's capacities to deal with the truth in a way that is not aggressive for them. So it's not that in that sense you're not being humble, you're a hypocrite, you're betraying yourself. You're being compassionate and sensitive, and that's a form of humility also. But in some situations, you need to take strong stance. If the other situation is abusive, the other person is abusive, then you may have to take another humble form, so to say, right? And again, each situation is very unique, and we need to develop discernment in that connection. And part of humility is also not being absolutely sure that I'm getting it right also, right? I mean, I'm trying to operate with the best of my hopeful intentions and capacities in how to be humble in any given situation. But part of my humility is to leave the door open that I may be more humble in a better way, but I'm where I am, so I'm open to be more humble. So I'm not also like completely sure I know how to be humble and everything.
Yeah.
So that's part of the humility. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's clear. Thank you.
Okay. So having said what humility is not, or how does play out in ways that use the facade of humility to avoid its substance, now let's for a minute do some brainstorming of, we already said something, but a little bit more, what does real humility look like? You say a few things already, but we can say a little bit more. Brown Chandra.
Authenticity.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Not duplicity. yeah. Sincere earnestness is what I'm sort of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Honesty.
Okay. What else? How, when I say what does look like, is of course how, which shape it takes in practice in our relationships. We are really humble. I don't know, for me, will be acknowledging your, one thing that comes to mind, your strengths and your limitations in a realistic way. No? Being humble. Yes.
Being willing to consider what another person is saying, even though I think or that I disagree with them.
Mm-hmm.
Being willing to open myself to their viewpoint.
Okay.
Even though, I mean, I know I disagree.
Yeah. Yeah.
Respecting them in that way.
Yeah. 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 One way that comes to my mind will be also being open to feedback without defensiveness.
Yeah.
Right? Even if I agree or disagree, but at least the openness to receive the other person. Yeah.
Acknowledging my own individuality and my own uniqueness and strengths,
mm-hmm.
and not trying to subordinate it to others, because I think that's part of authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
It's also part of my relationship and identity and relationship to Krishna and everyone else, actually.
Yeah.
Perhaps is humility having confidence in
yourself
and what you are.
Mm.
Yeah. So we're telling yesterday, no, in the class on confidence. So yeah, it may seem arrogant for some, but actually real confidence is a sign of humility. Because you know who you are, you know you're backed by Krishna, you know how loved you are by him, and so on. Also maybe recognizing our, at the same time, our smallness one level in the grand scheme of things without feeling insignificant, without feeling bad about myself. No? Like when you are in front of the ocean, you feel small, but it feels nice also at the same time. It's not a problem, right? Yeah. What else?
Feeling of dependence.
Uh-huh.
Dependence on the one hand and empowerment on the other hand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I'm just depending on Krishna and then he empowers me to do what I have to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's not me that's doing it. I'm just an instrument.
Yeah. Vulnerability also, entering to that place of vulnerability, it requires humility to be vulnerable and remain there. What else? Valuing the contributions of other people without diminishing your own. No, that also takes humility.
I think of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Gopinath prayers.
Okay.
Admitting my devious
shortcomings,
degradation or selfishness.
Mm.
I also think of one time when Duryodhana asked Prabhupada what humility is, he said, preaching boldly.
Again, not speaking the truth, basically, no? But again, with this sensibility that we are talking about. What else? What really humility looks like? Of course, and again, we go to some, I will say, serving others without seeking recognition, which again goes amani nama, and then we go to, we start, it's impossible not to go to the other ones in one way, right?
Does there have to be a basis of knowledge, Maharaj, for real humility to manifest? I mean, some wisdom must be there for humility to...
We could say. Mm-hmm. And we could say also you have some, how to say, you have some wealth, some gifts, and humility means you have that and you're not proud of that, right? You have to have something to be humble, so to say. And everyone has something. But sometimes we feel I have nothing, and that's not humility necessarily. Real humility is you have something, you can acknowledge what you have, maybe realization, gifts, but without feeling proud of that. I remember Thomas Merton once said that on one level of humility is someone tells you something nice. No, I have not. There's nothing good about me. Nothing. Everything is bad. So, okay. Humility, kindergarten level. On higher levels, you can acknowledge that you have some things, but also you can acknowledge that it's not just your own independent doing and merit. That requires another level of humility. Acknowledge your gifts. It's a gift. So you cannot be proud, but you have to acknowledge it, right? Yeah. Being willing to learn always, to remember, to remain always as a student. Well, that's also humility. Anyhow, some thoughts. Let's move forward, but I wanted just to... So Mahaprabhu here is speaking about humility, going back to our first line, Trinada Pisunicha, and he's referring to the symbol of the grass, Trinat. And that means grass. So why grass? That's interesting. This is the most important instruction that we will say, the most important thing that Mahaprabhu say begins with the word grass. That's interesting, right? Because generally grass is like, who cares for grass? And that's the first word of the most important thing of the most important person, grass. Don't skip the grass. Don't pay attention to the grass. You are surrounded by grass, so there's always grass. So always, the so-called ordinary, has something extraordinary to tell us. No? We have to pay close attention, which we will see. That's nishta. Nishta, you are more balanced and stable, so you are more able to pay attention, to be present, and to listen to what everything is telling you. Before nishta, we are a little bit more like this, up and down. So we. Our attention, our presence is more scattered. And nishta is such a condensed presence that you are looking at the grass is giving you a sermon, a gospel. It's a guru, as we all say, right? So grass, the very word humility, as you know, the Latin, it comes from the Latin humus. Humus? Yeah.
Earth?
Earth. Actually, humus is the earth fertile soil. And humility is connected to to humus. No? So we can reflect for a minute in that connection: humility, humus, earth, soil.
Is that connected to human?
I don't know that one. That's a good point. We can do some research, but it sounds like so. So humus, earth, ground, no? Grounded, returning to the ground, being grounded. Humility grounds us, no? Puts us in our place in a healthy way, who we actually are. Mm? And then I won't go there now, but remember the second line speaks about the tree. No, so tree also something very rooted. I mean, no, it's not coincidence that Mahaprabhu is using as his main symbol for this most important instruction, grass and a tree. No? So what? The earth also is sustaining everyone. All of us are being sustained by the earth, no? And it's serving us without asking for, hey, I'm sustaining you on a daily basis. Give me something back. It's just sustaining without recognition. That's a humble person acting like that. And the grass like that, sorry. And the grass that's similar. The grass seems like insignificant, but Prabhupada will say the cows feed on grass, and from that grass come milk, and from that come so many things. So grass in that sense is giving so much sustenance and nourishment to us, although we are not eating grass directly. But through that sequence, grass is maintaining humanity in so many ways. Sorry, but want to give us something.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt.
No, it's fine.
But it's another translation, isn't that? Lower than the straw in the street?
Yeah.
Sorry?
Lower than the straw in the street. Yeah. I mean, the straw is grass.
Uh-huh.
But it's sort of like, it's dead. It's dead.
It's dead.
It's dry. Yeah.
Yeah, but I will argue that's not the actual translation, right?
Oh, really?
I mean, that's the verse. You have the verse there.
Yeah. Okay.
Trinad means grass. Trinad means grass. Api means more. Sunichina means humble. So that's what the verse says. I mean, I'm not criticizing those translations. Maybe they want to make certain point. But the specific, I'm saying this because why? You are saying, okay, the grass on the street is dead. So that gives a message that is not intended to be given here. Because unconsciously we think, okay, then I have to. Of course, you can say you can be dead to your false ego and this and that, but sometimes it can translate inside of us in a more negative way. And we'll see that the grass is not, as I will make the point in a minute, the grass is bending, but not breaking. So that's how we have to be humble in a very skillful way, right?
Just one interjection. Just in relationship to that rendition with quiet being in there, even though it may not be.
Yeah, that's my poetic rendition. Yeah. I clarified that.
Yeah, no, but still very nice because I think quiet and I shared something the other day which said the letters within listen and silent are the same letters, they've just been. So when we're in a listening state, that. We're learning state, basically. We're in that quiet state,
quiet.
That silent state. So as a meditation on the quality of what's grass teaching us.
Thank you. We'll have some homework at the end to in relation to the grass. So you have some nice rendezvous with the grass today. One more thing, connection to humility and humus that come to my mind also, no? like decomposing, no? Like organic matter, human matter through decay becomes humus. So in one sense also we can speak about decomposing our false sense of identity, but that in itself becomes compost, becomes something that nourishes our real sense of identity. So humility, of course, is the breaking down of pride. But that has to be done in a way that is healthy and sustainable. No, it's not that. Let's bring the whip and destroy the false ego. No? But let's be humbled in a natural way, as we will try to talk today. When we are in front of something beautiful and moving, the false sense of identity shatters, but in a beautiful way, in a healthy way. No, it's not like imposition, an artificial imposition. So this verse again, first line invites us to be as humble as the quiet grass. once again, this imaginary, be as humble as the blade of grass or as the quiet grass, can lend itself to abuse. And as we say, a blade of grass can be taken as you become a doormat. Not like you're a blade of grass, you just walk on top of that. And blade of grass doesn't say anything, does not protest. So allow yourself to be walked on and don't say anything. Now, that's not the meaning of this verse, basically. Can you think of other ways in which we can interpret this in a toxic way, like be more humble than a blade of grass? Or maybe it comes, I don't know, endless self-sacrifice, no, to the point of being burnt out, no? Having no self-value and self-worth, or passive endurance. No? Like, again, connect to other lines, tolerating, but in a way that is unhealthy, is toxic.
We are advised to be meek and humble, so that I think it's often been misused that you should be a doormat, you should just do what you're told, whatever. So it's hard for me to make the distinction in a sense. What is real meekness? We're talking about real humility, but because we're advised to be meek and humble, I think that's one of the six instructions of Lord Chaitanya, isn't it?
Which six instructions?
Symptoms of surrender. Always consider oneself.
Dainya. That's one of the six angas of Saranagati, of surrender, yeah. Yeah, but again, humble in front of what? No? Humble in front of the truth. We should make and humble in front of the truth. No? In front of falsity, duplicity, hypocrisy, exploitation, our meekness will take a different shape. But meekness and humility and surrender, yeah, in front of the truth, someone who embodies the truth, the situation in my life, Krishna coming, I'm totally humble in front of the truth. But in front of falsity and lies and abuse, I will remain humble by remaining humble to the truth in that situation. You follow my point?
Yeah.
Our humility is toward the truth. So when falsity comes, I will submit to truth by taking a stance toward that falsity.
But not turning off the critical thinking.
Basically. Right.
Arjuna's fighting in the battle at the request of Krishna was actual humility. Paradoxically, on an external thing, it's like
he's submitting
to lord it over adversary.
Yeah. But he's submitting to Krishna's will, who is truth personified. So,
So you're saying not meek or submissive in the face of falsity, lying, cheating, manipulation. So to me, then my question becomes, all right, so how does humility bring me to the point of understanding this is falsity? Because so many things are presented in the name of Krishna or Prabhupada, philosophy or consciousness as authority. And we've experienced that so much. So then, I mean, I followed one of the Zonal Acharyas when I was a younger devotee. As if that was normal, as almost accepting that person on the level of Prabhupada. And now it's very clear, and it has been for a long time, that wasn't valid. It wasn't real. It wasn't real authority. So how do I apply it to my humility to distinguish that this is not what Krishna wants?
Yeah, well, it's a process, no? Because at a certain time, we try to be humble, as I say, with the tools we have, with the realization we have, with the knowledge we have, and that's totally valid. But still, we may have a wrong picture of things, and we cannot just force ourselves to be enlightened and have the perfect discernment when we are 22 or 25. We may need to go through some life experiences when we're like, oh, I thought this was that, and now I realize this was, no, I thought this was bona fide, and I realized this was abuse. Okay, now that I know it, I take a stance. No? So that's my humility. Before that, I tried to be humble with the realization, vision, guidance, knowledge I had. So if I'm sincere, that will take me to whenever I'm in a situation with like abuse of some of these situations, I will recognize, oh, I cannot submit myself to this anymore. Now I'm seeing it. So it's a process. It's not that in advance we can be given like a take this pill and you will have perfect discernment throughout your whole life and you will always be perfectly humble. No, sometimes we need to stumble upon situations and make wrong choices and learn through suffering. But if at least we are sincere in our inquiry and service to the truth, that's what Srila Saramash will say, that sincerity is invincible. No? So even if I'm immature, naive, not seeing the whole picture, but I'm sincerely trying to submit to the truth, that's humility. In time, my humility will become more mature, more informed, more educated, more discerning. But still, we can have the best capacity of humility we can when we are a toddler in spiritual life. No? And then life will take us along. We will go through experiences and educate ourselves as well. Yeah.
So that discernment in its immature phase can be somewhat, that's a question really, but can be somewhat molded by the modality of that Kanishna platform where we're very much in a dualistic kind of perception of reality. And even we know that the Uttam Bhakta comes down to the Madhyam platform to be able to make himself relevant to a kind of modality that can be applied to the persons in that situation.
Yeah.
So in that sense, even though it's relatively, absolutely, it may be a position of ignorance because it's in relationship to a circumstantial situation of that a Kanishta mentality. Mm-hmm. Then I can say that the way that that's being dealt with doesn't disturb the minds of ignorance, so to speak. Mm-hmm. It's Krishna's or the Guru's is encouraging in a way that's progressive for those people and not disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is that a valid understanding?
Yep. Yeah. Thank you. So, yeah, in summary, again, paradoxically, in order to have deep humility, as the one Mahaprabhu is inviting here, we have to have deep self-respect at the same time. Again, it's not about becoming a doormat. Like Thomas Merton once, he said, humility, I like that. He said, humility is a virtue, not a neurosis.
Neurosis.
Because for some, it becomes a neurosis. No? Yeah. I have to be humble means it has to be a virtue, something that makes you virtuous and that gives you dignity, basically. It has to be dignifying. That's a good word to use, no? That's a good, like, yardstick. Are these virtues, all this virtues, humility, tolerance, is dignifying? No? Is honoring who I am as a soul beloved by Krishna or not? No? As much as we can discern, that is a good way of asking the question and putting that in place. So I was saying that the imaginary of the grass is not about become a doormat, no self-respect, but means what does the grass do? It bends without breaking. So how to bend without breaking ourselves? That's the challenge of proper humility. Proper humility bends, inclines itself, we incline toward the truth, but in a way that we do not break, right? So for me, that's a genius-like example that Mahaprabhu brings. Okay, he's given the grass. What does the grass do? It's bending. The wind comes like this, moves, but it's not breaking. So in other words, make your humility sustainable. Be humble in a way that you do not end up being a broken being, dysfunctional, paranoid, neurotic, as Thomas Merton will say.
It's the good thing about grass, I understand, is that grows from the root, you can slice it.
Mm-hmm.
The energy is in the root and the grass.
Mm.
aspect, isn't it?
So yeah, we should learn lots of lessons from the grass, as you can say.
You can never chop something down.
Mm-hmm.
If you think like this, you can never feel chopped down.
Mm. Yeah, so again, humility has to be rooted in, okay, Krishna loves me, as we were saying yesterday. I'm beloved of God. That's my dignity. It's not pride. It's just who I am and what it is. There's some dignity. So we honor that dignity and we bend with that rootedness in who we are in connection to God. And our bending will be in acknowledgement to that root. And therefore, it's not leading to being broken people.
But people tread on grass, right? You get grass is walked on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
How do you extend the metaphor to that?
Not necessarily we should. That's the thing with metaphors or analogies, not that you can use them to give one idea and to give the opposite idea sometimes. But sometimes an analogy is used with certain intention in mind. So we have to match that intention, no? So, okay, Mahaprabhu is using the grass here to illustrate humility. Okay, and he's speaking about humility, which should be healthy, dignifying. So how do I read the grass in a way that is dignifying and not in a way that lends itself for exploitation? So, yeah, I wouldn't explain this first line. Yeah, you should be walked upon like grass is and just be quiet and do not say anything.
Only if you're grass in Goloka Vrindavan, walked on by Krishna.
Yes, that's another department, but yeah, it applies. So as long as we are not in Goloka Vrindavan, you have to understand this verse in a different way. But that's my point, like the analogies are useful to prove a point, but analogies can be used in so many directions. So we have to be very careful to get that. The analogy in the correct direction. And in a minute, I will go to another analogy in this connection that has been used to demand humility sometimes in a way that is toxic. Mm-hmm. The analogy of lower than the worm in the stool. Mm-hmm. What to do with that line? Mm-hmm. We'll go there in a minute. But again, just to reinforce this point, Mahaprabhu's call to humility here is not about self-deprecation. Or bring the whip of self-rejection and guilt and shame, or not about competing or being the most fallen, as we were quoting the other day, this is what telling Prabhupada, I'm your most fallen disciple, and Prabhupada, you are not the most anything. Don't try to be the most something. That in itself is a problem. But actually the humility involves flexibility, adaptation, no? Willingness to learn, to be flexible in relation to the truth, a willingness to grow, a willingness to transform. All that is humility. Mm-hmm. Willingness to learn, to grow, to transform. Mm-hmm. And sometimes even if that invites us to take a strong stance, in some cases to remain submissive to the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That is the essence of true humility, submission to the truth. I like to share a few powerful words from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, but Tribhukram has something.
Well, just because Bhaktimag brought up the idea of, you know, that grass does get walked on.
Uh-huh.
And that is kind of like the reality of life, in a sense, not like we kind of say, yeah, please come and walk on me.
Mm-hmm.
And not that we validate things or make a philosophy to mm-hmm. justify that. That. At the same time, if you think in another analogy of a child walking all over the mother or the
mm-hmm.
the parent,
mm-hmm.
it's not like the child's, you know, perceived by the parent to be doing something that's entitled or,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just because the parent's perspective is totally different.
Mm.
So in terms of, you know, life happening and the realities of the world, mm. we do get walked over, but to be up in arms about, you know, don't walk on me. And that's just kind of another dualistic kind of perception, which creates conflict, obviously. But when we realize that, no, according to that person's level of perception, they're unaware of it, or, you mm-hmm. know, that's just what they have to do to feel adjusted in this world. That's basically the mudjum dealing with the condition, mm-hmm. I suppose you'd say.
Yeah, what comes to mind is also in relation to that, thank you, is that, okay, if you want to apply that idea, okay, the grass is walked upon and doesn't protest, could mean also, okay, some situations come to your life, you're not asking for them, but they come. And it's not that you allow everything and anything, but in one sense, you accept the situation. That will be accepting to be walked on, upon, but not in the way of accepting to be abused or anything, but if something comes, you cannot control if that comes or not, but you're acknowledging it's coming, you're accepting it's coming, and you're trying to learn from that. So that's as much as I will extend the idea of grass being walked upon, like life walks upon you, not in any negative way, but just situations come that you feel walked upon you, but for some reason this is coming, no? So I have to accept the lesson that is trying to be, in that sense, we could say, again, humility as submission to the truth. Okay, there is some truth that wants to be talked to me through this situation. I'm accepting that.
Before you move on to this amazing quote, just before we move off from the class, before you mentioned the word defensive, and, you know, personally for myself, I find that's just like, oh, no, when I'm defensive, I just feel like so bad. It's so unhumble and feel so complex about being defensive. And I was thinking that the grass, like when it says the quiet grass,
mm-hmm.
like I think that's a time when I should be really quiet instead of being defensive. It's really horrible when you're just triggered and you're defensive, you know, you're just defensive, you know, and then mm-hmm. you say something, so you're not, you know, you're not like, I was thinking that that's quiet grass. Would you agree that that's a really good use of being quiet? Because, you know, when you're just being defensive because you've been triggered, I'm not talking about in a truthful situation, just when you're just being defensive due to your own trauma or your own estimation of yourself, it's just such, or whatever it is, you know, it's like, it's just so.
Yeah, of course, sometimes I will say we need to establish proper boundaries. I will maybe call that being defensive. I will say just, again, if we have some self-worth and dignity, there's some healthy boundaries that has to be established when some other people try to trample on us.
Mm-hmm.
I won't say that's being defensive, but in regards to our false sense of self being challenged, and we're becoming
not a healthy.
That's not submission to the truth. Yeah. Of course, not to feel again neurotic about it, but good to acknowledge that and to realize, I have to learn my lesson here, and I have to increase my humility by being open to be challenged in what needs to be challenged, no? So to say, and that's submission to the truth again. It's what this Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur says. So I will go to the quotes because I have a few more things to share. He says, I quote this, I share this in the book, in Radical Personalism. So he defines humility very interestingly. He says, it's a long quote, so not so long. A chanter of the names of God, and again, this verse is speaking about chanting the name of God, so it's all in connection. A chanter of the names of God is necessarily the uncompromising enemy of worldliness and hypocrisy. It is his bounden duty to clearly and frankly oppose any person who tries to deceive and harm himself and others by misrepresenting the truth, whether due to malice or genuine misunderstanding. Humility implies perfect submission to the truth and no sympathy for untruth. That's the main line, I will say. Humility implies perfect submission to the truth and no sympathy for untruth. Therefore, the professors of pseudo-humility have reason to fear the preaching of God's servant, one of whose duties is to expose the enormous possibility of mischief inherent in various forms of so-called spiritual conduct when they are prostituted for serving the untruth.
Maharaj, could you just repeat the last couple of lines?
Okay. Then if not, I can send to you the page in the book, because it's in Radical Personalism, if you want to read it in detail. Humility implies perfect submission to the truth and no sympathy for untruth. Therefore, the professors, those who profess pseudo-humility, have reason to fear the preaching of God's servant, one of whose duties is to expose the enormous possibility of mischief inherent in various forms of so-called spiritual conduct when they are prostituted for serving the untruth. So different things that we have been talking about so far. Spiritual bypassing, in other words, resorting to spirituality to not serve the truth, which means to not be humble, how the real servant of God is. Of course, how we do all this, which shape it takes, because we may hear all this and it's like, yes, let's destroy everyone. And it's like, how to do that gracefully, with compassion, with proper criteria in any case. So the humility that is being talked about here has to be applied in different ways, in certain ways according to time, place, and circumstance. So another definition that Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur gave of humility, since we are quoting him and talking of humility, it's an interesting one. He said once, indirectly, he's saying, humility is that which is absent when there is an enjoying spirit. Oh. I'll say it again, right? Humility is that which is absent when there is an enjoying spirit. In other words, when I relate to everything with me in the center, that's not humble. When I forget who is the center and I put myself there and I see everything and relate to everyone like, all of this is for my enjoyment, all of this is to serve me, that's not humility. So that's another yardstick. There are different yardsticks to measure humility.
Depersonalization.
Well, yeah, self-centeredness versus acknowledging Sambandha, real center, who is who, which is my connection, right? So that said, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I want to go to another of these lines that sometimes may be used to, or someone may be in that argument. Okay, so far so good, Maharaj, very nice, humility in a healthy way. But we have this line in Chaitanya Charitamrita. What?
I didn't saw that.
Excuse me.
I was going to say that this is how I was interpreting also the concept of the grass, as being as in relation to self-importance, because the grass is ubiquitous; it's absolutely everywhere. And so, not to see ourselves as so big and important, because we're all in this together. There's so many of us; we're all blades of grass.
That's a good one. Thank you. I will add that one to that. There's so many ways, yes, you are bringing other perspectives that we can really draw from that. So again, someone may bring this argument. Chaitanya Charitamrita said, Jagai madai haite munise papita purushara kita haite munise lagisna. Krishna Dakaras Goswami says, I'm lower than the worm in the stool. And I've seen that sometimes. Unfortunately, this line is again weaponized to like demand a type of submission and humility that ends up being about making you feel as miserable as you can with yourself. No? So how to understand that line? Because still there in Chaitanya Charitamrita, we cannot just edit the book and delete the line because it's troublesome. So there's an interesting way to interpret this line in a healthy way.
I hope you...
We could.
Yeah. Bear with me, wait. Navigate with me along the journey. First of all, a few things. First of all, of course, that verse is not saying you should be that, you should feel that, but the author of Chaitanya Charitamrita is speaking for himself. No, first. No, he's not saying all of you are that, all of you should feel that. If you want to take it, he's talking about himself first. And we are not Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami, so we don't know from which place he's talking. Of course, he's talking from a place of divine love. In that sense, we don't know what's that because we are not there yet. So I'll share a few words after that in a minute. From which place, what was the thing he may have been feeling for him to say that, for him. But for us, and in connection, again, remember I mentioned humility in connection to humus. So I'd like to tell you a story that is told to explain this verse in this connection, how this idea of lower than the worm in the stool can be connected with healthy humility and the idea of humus. And in this way, we can hopefully redeem this verse in our lives. And whenever we hear that or quote that, it can be from a healthy perspective. So the story goes like this. There was some there was one scholar, devotee scholar from Bengal, and he went to Vrindavan. And he wanted to accept initiation from a well-known sadhu in Vrindavan. But this devotee scholar had some pride in him due to the fact of being a scholar. No, it can happen. You have knowledge, you have charisma, you may think you are above the normal standard of people, quote unquote. So he came to his prospective guru, and the guru kind of perceived, okay, you are proud. And you are coming for initiation. But he thought, before giving initiation, you need to realize your pride. You need to become more humble, because if not, you won't be able to take advantage of initiation, something like this, the initiation I want to give. So the guru tells the disciple, okay, I give you, before giving initiation, I have a homework for you to do. In the next week, I give you 7 days to find someone who is inferior to you in every single aspect. Inferior to you in all respects. And the scholar thought, oh, that will be easy. No, because again, I'm special. I have this and this quality. I very easily can find someone who is inferior to me in every aspect. So he went, thinking, I'll be back in half an hour, 7 days. I don't need that much time, right? So he goes. And again, he's going in service to his guru. So already the instruction of the guru is there, and it's starting to have an effect on him in terms of purifying himself. So he goes and he looks at a human being walking there. Okay, he's inferior to me in this way, in this way, in this way, almost. But at some point he finds something that, oh, I don't have that. So, okay, okay, that's not the person, another human. Okay, he's inferior to me in all this, but, oh, he has this virtue that I don't have. So he's already in the process of transformation. Okay. Then he says, a few days passing, okay, it's not working with humans. I'll go to the animal kingdom. Because Gurudev didn't make a limit into that. So, okay, I'll go to an animal kingdom. So he goes to one animal. He's indeed, of course, lower than me in this. But, oh, he has a quality that I don't know. Oh, these birds, I cannot fly like a bird. Or this other animal has this instinct. I don't have that deep instinct. So he's kind of like, okay, no. Days are passing. Then he goes to the plant kingdom, right? Okay, the tree for sure is lower than me in every respect. And then, oh, Tarori Vasa Krishna. Oh no, the tree is so tolerant, and the tree is this. Okay. The grass must be inferior to me in all respect. Oh, Trinada Pisanichin. No. It has some quality that I don't have. So, of course, in this whole process, this person is becoming humbler and humbler and humbler. And the days are passing, and he's feeling, oh, I will not be able to bring anyone. And Gurudev won't give me initiation if I fail his request, right? He's thinking that way. So it was the last day. 6 days had passed. He has one more day to bring to his guru to find someone who is lower than him in all respects. And he's becoming very desperate, because I won't give initiation. He was thinking that way. So he's in the morning having a bath. He's passing stool in nature. And at one point, after passing a stool, he's cleaning himself, and he sees then there's a worm in the stool. Sorry for the imaginary. That is what it is. And finally, he thinks, okay, finally I get something. I can bring this example to Gurudev and be initiated. The worm in the stool is lower than me in every sense. But then, again, having been transformed by so many days of finding virtue in others, his mind is already crafted, has been crafted through this week to find something good. So he's like, okay, this worm in the stool is lower than me in every way. And he's like, no. Actually, this stool is the result of me eating. And now, me honoring Prashad, I made Prashad's stool. Yeah. No? And I'm not capable of now turning this impure substance into something pure. But this worm is doing that. This worm is transforming stool in compost. Therefore, I'm lower than the worm in the stool. So that was his conclusion, right? From that place. And of course, then he went to his guru, very discouraged in one sense, thinking, Gurudev, I failed the test. I haven't found anyone who is lower than me in all respects. So probably you can see that I'm not fit to receive initiation because I failed your test. And his guru is crying tears of joy, realizing, well, you have been transformed this week, and now is the moment for you to receive initiation. You're ready for that. Mm-hmm. So this story is helping us to have another perspective of what it means to be lower than the worm in the stool. Mostly has to do with even the worm in the stool is teaching me a lesson. I cannot do what he's doing. So that's the spirit of those lines, not so much like you are that. You follow my point? Mm-hmm. Did it help the story to redeem a little bit the meaning of that line?
It did help, but when I said, oh, you could change it, I wasn't really thinking about the particular verse. The verse doesn't worry me. I was thinking how people have changed the books in order to satisfy their, that was why I was sort of like, oh, yeah, you could, because other verses have been changed to fit.
Yeah.
Criteria. That was,
It's totally fine. Thank you. And I think it's important that it's not that we are here forcing some imaginary meaning, but that actually we relate to Shastra and examples, because sometimes examples in the scripture are also given with coming from certain time and culture and imaginary that is proper from that time. And we may be living we are living in another time and we use another symbol. So what does that symbol mean? What they are pointing to? If we are not able to make that clear, we may get a very dysfunctional meaning from those sections like this one, and we may just be using the worm and the stool as a way of like canceling your existence, basically, right? So that said, before moving forward, I like to make an exercise in between our sharing, if we are willing, to make it a little more interactive. Yes? Mm-hmm. For a few minutes. And then we continue sharing for a few more minutes before concluding. It will be a group exercise. So I like in groups of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I count myself there. So we can make three groups of three. And I will say briefly, just maximum 10 minutes it will take, so we don't make it that long. So each one of us will share one example from our own life where we have seen that humility or some of the qualities in this verse, we can extend it, have been misused in community dynamics, in our personal experience. No need to bring names or anything, but some situation. And after each example, the group can share a little bit like how to redeem that misinterpretation, how to heal that, how it's a proper way to conceive that, how to embody in a healthy way humility in this case. Is it clear?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm not sure I have this one.
No,
okay, I will make it. So we will get in groups of three for a few minutes, mm-hmm. and each one will share an example from your own life experience where you felt that humility was, the idea of humility was misused or abused, misrepresented in the name of humility.
We're expecting us to be humble.
Us or someone else that you saw that you have witnessed what we have shared today, what healthy humility is not.
You mean what was observed in someone else, or what we've reacted to?
Yeah, whether it's observing someone else, whether it's like we did that to others, whether someone else tried to do it onto ourselves, whatever. One example that may come, if it comes, and then we can briefly discuss which will be a healthy way to counteract that toxic version of humility for a few minutes. Right, and when we are back, and we share for a few more minutes before closing our presentation. Okay, so here we are back. I hope the exercise had some purpose. It's always needed to take some time to share with one another and continue bonding with one another in the context of this conversation. Sorry to interrupt that. I know that once we open the door, it's like we need 3 hours to be.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully we continue the stage sharing. So a few more thoughts before we bring a close to this topic, if you accompany me for a few more minutes on the topic of humility and this first line of Sikshastakam 3. So we concluded before the exercise on this verse of Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami saying lower than the worm in the stool. And we were also mentioning, okay, but from which place he may be saying that? What he's feeling, what he's realizing, what's the type of humility, extreme humility he's experiencing that makes him feel so small. And not again, not in any dysfunctional way, in a very ecstatic way, which we cannot imitate. But somehow we it's good to try to understand it as much as we can. So for me comes this idea of, comes Mahaprabhu to mind. And Mahaprabhu will say in one occasion, na prema gandoshti darapi haru me. He will say, in me, there is not even the aroma of divine love. That's Mahaprabhu speaking. He's a personification of divine love. If he doesn't have love, nobody has love, right? Because he was, Srila Siddha Maharaj will say, a golden volcano of divine love. But he will say, I don't have even the aroma of that. Like he will give the example, like if you put in a little box some camphor, okay, but then you take out the camphor, still the aroma remains. Mahaprabhu say, I don't even have the aroma of that. But at the same time, we see he has so much love. So what's the experience of this? No, you have so much love, and that takes you to say you have no love. No. I connect that with the humility of Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. He has so much humility, so much, he's so high, but he's saying, I'm this. And this is the paradoxical experience of love, basically. When you have love, you feel you don't have love. When you have humility, you feel you don't have humility. When you have humility, you don't feel you have humility. Humility have that nature. The moment I say, I'm so humble, you stop being humble. It's very paradoxical. So when you have love for Krishna, the nature of love is ever evolving. So if you have love for Krishna, means I have love for Krishna, but I can have so much more love for Krishna than by comparison to all that I can have, but I don't have any love for Krishna. I always think, like, for example, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Atmananda Prabhu was referring to
Gopinath prayers.
To Gopinath prayers. And in some of the prayers, Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say things like, I am full of lust. So you have to do something with that. Like, is he speaking the truth? I mean, is Bhaktivinoda Thakur full of lust? What do you think? I don't think so. So why he's saying that? Is he just, okay, I will write this song for all these lusty guys that will read my songs in time so they can identify with that? I wouldn't say also that's the case. I don't think he's kind of calculating what he's writing. He's really meaning it, but he doesn't have it. So again, how to explain that? So for me, that's the same idea. He has so much love for Krishna that having love for Krishna takes him to see how much more love can be had. And in comparison to that infinite prospect, he goes back and he says, I'm full of lust. It's not that he's full of lust, but that's a paradoxical and humbling experience of love. The more you have it, the less you feel you have it. So that's a very interesting idea because, again, humility is very connected with this. The more love you have, the more humble you become. When you get a glimpse of the infinite prospect of love, you feel very, very humble, very small, very happy at the same time, Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say, the moment you enter in contact with the infinite, you realize that there is no limit to progress. And that's humbling. You got a glimpse of the infinite and you realize, wow. I cannot like fully assert myself, like I'm here and I've realized this because infinite progress, infinite progress. So that's humbling, right? That's why Bhakti, Srila Sanatana Goswami, he will say, love and humility are cause and effect of one another. The more humility you have, the more closer you get to love. The more love you have, the humbler you become. The humbler you become, the more your love up grows, and so on. One is nourishing the other. So that's basically the idea. And I will say from that place, Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami is saying what he's saying, which for us may sound like a little bit like too much, but what he's experiencing is too much. So that takes him to express in ways that we may not be able to imitate. We cannot copy paste him, but we can make our best to understand. He's experiencing infinite love, ever-evolving love, and it takes him to feel himself so humble and express himself in this way. One more thing before we conclude, in connection to this verse, Trinada Pisunichena, to this first line, he's learning from the grass. We hinted at that in the beginning. As we say, in Nishta, this verse speaks about Nishta. Nishta means you're balanced, you're stable, you're fixed, and you are more present. You are not that scattered. Your mind is more one-pointed, so you can pay attention to what's going on. You can be present, really present. So you can listen to the grass. You can listen to the tree. You are seeing the tree and you are not seeing the tree. You are seeing a guru. You are seeing the grass and the grass is talking to you. Humble. Be humble. When you are in Nishta, you really are present. So you realize, wow, the whole environment is friendly. The environment is teaching me. It's talking to me. Oh, it's my guru. So Nishta implies the type of practice or state where make the whole world come alive in front of our life, in front of our eyes. Try to imagine what that must be. That already taking place, but due to not being in Nishta, we are a little bit too much like fragmented here and there, distracted. So when Nishta comes, Mahaprabhu is exhibiting this here in this verse. The tree is my guru. The grass is talking to me. So instead of me trying to transform nature, like sometimes modern civilization, science, society, let's take nature, manipulate that. No, pay attention to nature and be transformed by its message. Nature is holy and sacred. It's trying to tell us something, right? And that's a big point in the Bhagavatam, as we were talking these days. In the Bhagavatam, in the 11th canto, we find these 24 gurus. Most of them are elements of nature. The first one is the earth. Again, going back to humus, humility, earth, soil. The first one, earth. Then comes wind, the moon, the sun, the water, nature. Only three humans are there in the list of 24. Mm-hmm. Humans, okay, three of them. Let's include 10. And many are animals and different elements from nature. And as I said, the three humans are what? One is a baby. One is a young girl, like Nayan Mani, and the third one is a prostitute. That's it. And the Bhagavatam said, you have to learn from all that. That's the point. In those places where you think, I have nothing to learn from a prostitute. What will I learn from a baby? From nature? You have to learn from. From what you think is ordinary, you have to rediscover your relationship with the ordinary and realize guru is everywhere. Ultimately, we may have one guru that initiates us or guides us, but that guru has to instruct us in a way that he shows or she shows us guru is everywhere. Grass is guru, tree is guru, baby is guru, guru is everywhere. So that's basically the idea. No, nature is talking to us. The question is, am I listening? It's not so much where's the guru, where's the lessons are everywhere, but are we present? No, like I sometimes like to say, we feel like Krishna is not present in my life. But Krishna is always present. Krishna is omnipresent. Sometimes if I feel that someone omnipresent is not present, that means that I'm omni-absent. Because Krishna is omnipresent. So if you feel the absence of someone omnipresent, that speaks about your omni-absence. That's the only thing. So it's not so much like, Krishna, where are you? But where am I? How present am I? How much I am listening? So again, the closer we get to Nishta, the closer we embrace these values, the more everything around us, the more I'm present and I'm really listening, wow, everything starts to speak and teach us and be a friend of us, right? We are surrounded by gurus, basically. And nature is a big guru, so we have to honor nature and be careful not to think, oh, material world is crap, nature is bad, it's a problem. It's a guru. My last chapter on radical personalism is on that, unearthing heaven. How you from earth, you can unearth heaven in on earth, so to say, right? Have something, Mother Amrita?
I was just thinking, my guru says that to always look at devotees and, you know, appreciate what they're doing, the qualities they have in their service, like that.
Yeah.
So extending that to what you're saying, when we see nature,
yeah,
is it like we're looking for all these qualities that different aspects of nature have to help us,
yeah,
develop those qualities as well?
Yeah, totally. Totally. Nature is serving Krishna in its own way already. No? The tree is serving Krishna by being a tree. The tree is not trying to be something more than a tree. The tree is accepting, I'm a tree, I'm a tree. We are not doing that. We are not okay with who we are. We are always trying to be more, or we end up being less, but the tree is just fine being a tree. So it's a very deep lesson of also self-acceptance. And of course, Bhumi, or the earth, in the scriptures describes a hike, very advanced devotee. So we can see nature as a Vaishnava, as a Vaishnavi. No, so we're being instructed. Yeah,
I was just thinking of that quotation in your book, you know, by Thomas Merton, that talks about that very
the tree. Yeah, yeah, I would think about him when I say that. A tree is really, he nice. Says something like, the tree is bringing glory to God by just being a tree, right? No, not pretending, just I'm a tree, and that in itself, God comes to us through that. So if we have the eyes to see again. Mm. So that's what Mahaprabhu is saying here. He's looking at the grass. He's looking at the tree. He's not looking at some fancy tree that has a sign saying tolerance. So that reminds him of tolerance. He sees any tree, this tree, that tree. So again, nishtha means, we could translate nishtha as pay close attention. We may not be there, but we can do our best to try to get closer to that, to cultivate presence in our practice, in our sadhana, to spend some time trying to be as present as we can. Sometimes it even, there's this meditation that sometimes they even say, try to be present in your body. Mm-hmm. Try to see what you feel in your body. Try to be present. Try to breathe, pay attention. It sounds superficial, but it's a way to preparing. That's why the yoga system has pranayama before the other practice. Like, try to bring presence to your practice. No? Sanatana Goswami in Hari Bhakti Vilas says this, and before chanting japa, he says, that's interesting, he says, you should practice like 20 minutes of pranayama, he says. And he's saying that 500 years ago in the village lifestyle he was living, to quiet your mind and be present. Now that could be maybe 7 hours of pranayama before. not practical, I know, but we have to get the point. Don't try to do something to bring presence to you, to your practice when you're about to chant, to meditate. If not, you are Hare Krishna, but your mind is going shopping everywhere. So presence is important, because if you are not present, you are where? In the past, in the future, and you are missing the experience of the present. You can only have an experience in the present moment. We want to have experiences in Krishna consciousness. That can only happen in the present moment. We are traveling in the past and in the future, you won't have an experience. So the present is the only place we can be, basically. Let's put it that way, right?
Omniabsent.
Yeah. Yeah. Sattva. Sattva is a lot about being in the present also. Right? Tamaguna is more about nostalgia, the past. Rajaguna is more anxiety and future. Sattvaguna means here now. So... And remaining present and being a lifelong learner, as Mahaprabhu is teaching. He's seeing a grass. He's not saying, what do I have to learn from a grass? I'm Mahaprabhu. He's a student, as we say, student forever. No? Keeping that ethic. In Buddhism, they have this expression, shoshin, which means beginner's mind. Something that you have to keep always, not only when you are a beginner. But keeping a beginner's mind all along the way, even if you are a Zen master, so to say. Still you feel, I'm just beginning, because this is endless, this is eternal, so I can always be learning. No? Jesus will say, you have to become like children if you want to enter the kingdom of God. Remain curious, remain open to wonder, to discovery, to surprise. If not, we become toxically certain about, I already know what Krishna consciousness is about. I'm a senior devotee, I'm Maharaj, I'm this. And you take for granted. And the magic is lost. You become stagnant and you forgot this verse altogether. Can I share one more thing?
Yes.
Can you, yeah? Can you tolerate 10 more minutes with this first line? You see how much is just in these three words, no? If we really take the time to sit and turn the whole thing. Something that I would like to do is, and I'm writing a book on unconditional love, on Krishna's unconditional love. And one chapter of the book will be this verse of Shikshastakam read through the lenses of unconditional love. So how can we can understand each one of the main virtues here in the context of Krishna's unconditional love. So I'd like to conclude today's meeting with that, and I will conclude every other meeting of the other qualities on that note. How can we be humbler as a blade of grass because of the fact that Krishna loves us and everyone unconditionally? I think it's an important, very positive way of addressing this verse, very healing also. Of course, so far we have tried to provide a healing and unhealthy reading of this first line, but I think this point of unconditional love is kind of the icing on the cake, so to say. So to begin with, okay, be as humble as the quiet grass. If we enter into this space, each one of you and everyone is already loved by Krishna unconditionally. No matter who they are, no matter where you are, no matter what you are doing or not, Krishna is loving you and accepting you fully. We should be deeply humbled by that, by the fact that Krishna is loving everyone, that each one of you, if I'm relating to you and I know you are ever loved of Krishna, that puts the whole relationship and puts you in another perspective to me. You are the beloved of God. So I humble myself before that fact, right? I bow to the fact that you are loved by Krishna. Even if you are a mess on every other level, which sometimes happens, there's at least one thing for me to humble, to incline, to put my head on the ground. You are loved by God. And beyond all that mess, as we said the other day, your soul is incredible. The soul is incredible. You are incredible, actually. And Krishna loves that incredibleness. So I humble myself to that. Even if I cannot humble myself to any other thing you are doing, if that's dysfunctional or abusive or who knows what, there's always something I can bow my head to. Even the quiet grass is being loved by Krishna. No? Krishna loves everything. His love personified. Taittiriya Upanishad says, Raso Vaisaha, his love. So if you are love, you cannot not love. Imagine if you are made of love. You cannot not love because you are made of that. You have no option. That's a limitation of Krishna. He cannot not love. A glorious limitation. It's our greatest fortune. No? So this humility extends to everything. No? Even the quiet grass is being loved by Krishna. The grass is humbly, lovingly sustained by God's love. So everyone else says we should be humble by that. And of course, we are being loved by Krishna. When I say Krishna is loving everyone, don't make yourself an exception to that rule. Because we are experts sometimes at mistreating us. Okay, Krishna loves everyone except for me. How he can love me? I mean, I'm horrible. I'm useless. I'm worthless. I'm crap. Sometimes we have that mantra activated. So no, you are also included in the equation. We are loved by Krishna without limits, infinitely. Because that's how he loves. We cannot even think about that. That's difficult to imagine. Even if I imagine that the more I say that, the more maybe you may feel uncomfortable. Like, how can he love me infinitely? It's not possible. It's too much. Because we have our own limited idea of us, love, Krishna. But he's of infinite love. So we should be humble not only by the fact that Krishna loves everyone infinitely, but that we are being loved by him infinitely. Who we are in Krishna's eyes. something, as we say the other day, something we find, he finds amazing, three times. Acharyavat. That's who we are. In Krishna's eyes, I'm wonderful. Wow, I'm humbled by that. Again, my own wonderfulness should lead me to a type of humility, because as we say, it's not that I'm wonderful and I created that myself. I'm not my own creation. But the soul happens to be wonderful in Krishna's eyes. I cannot argue with that. I cannot start a debate. No, Krishna, I will argue back that soul is not wonderful, at least not my soul. That means you are identifying yourself with something else, not with who you are, right? So we happen to be wonderful as souls, and we should be humble by that. And just to conclude, the fact that Krishna is loving us unconditionally should lead to deep humility. Why? Because while Krishna's love and mercy is costless, as we will say sometimes, I will say it's not priceless. There is a price to pay, not to be loved by Krishna, but there is a price to pay to allow ourselves to feel that love in a proper way. And the price to pay is humility. In which sense? Krishna is loving me infinitely, and I did nothing to deserve that. That's humbling. For lifetimes, maybe I oppose God. I say, God does not exist. I mean, at least in this lifetime, I did that for some time in my life. And still in that moment, Krishna is loving me unconditionally. So it's not that I have a long list of absolute merits that match how Krishna is loving me. I'm not saying you did not do anything good. I'm just saying the amount of love that comes from Krishna. You can never, as I like to say, Krishna's love is too much to be deserved. It's not about deserving it. The more you try to deserve it, you are deserving it. You're unserving it. You're not serving it properly, right? So that's a deep humility when you realize I am being granted a gift that no matter what I do, I can never deserve it. But I deeply need it. And it's being fully given. That's very, probably that's the more humble, the greatest humility we will experience is by that. Someone gives me a big gift and you are like, why you are giving me this gift? Because I love you. You're totally humble in that moment. There's no place for pride in that situation. So for me, that's the most effective way of being humble. Not just, you are such an egotistic demon, you have to be more humble, but you are being loved infinitely and unconditionally. It's a free gift. Wow. I'm humble and moved to tears because of that, right? And we have to struggle with that, because many times it doesn't make sense to us that things work like that. We generally think I have to do something in order to earn and deserve something. That's more the ego part. Do cause and effect, action, reaction. But in this case, you are being loved by Krishna without having done anything about it. So it like breaks that system of ego deserving, earning thing, and it's so humbling. So that's the idea. God, the love of Krishna is a gift. So if we are aware that it's a gift, we have no reasons to be proud of that. I cannot be proud of a gift that was given so generously. So anyhow, some thoughts in connection to how the idea of unconditional love can, how this first line, be as humble as the quiet grass, can be read through the lenses of Krishna's unconditional love. So I think we can put the discussion to rest now. And not only the discussion, maybe each of us. but I will give you a small homework. It's simple, if you want, not forced. We have our next meeting tomorrow in the evening, so we'll have almost 2 days in between. And basically will be that spend some time observing nature. Maybe you may like to walk barefoot in the grass. In connection to our first line, grass being the central symbol of today's class. And try to reflect more on the lessons. Okay, what lessons the grass is offering me about humility, about flexibility, about adaptability, what I'm being invited to in that direction. And if you want, of course, you can then write a little bit about your realizations, what came to that, and how those qualities can manifest in your life and inspire your growth. Yeah?
Yeah.
Invited. It's an open invitation.
Get in
that
with a bee sting.
Sorry again?
Oh, the bees will sting over on the grass if you go barefoot over there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, had a bee sting recently.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I know.
Depends on what patch of grass there.
Yeah, find
yeah, find yours. Okay, so thank you so much to all.
Just one thing.
Yeah, yeah.
To see if I understood properly your last point about humility and Krishna's love. So
yes.
You're inviting us to experience humility by understanding how much Krishna loves us and that we don't deserve it. Is that your understanding? Because you said it's like a price to pay to actually feel Krishna's love is to be humble about it.
Yeah, because if we are not, I mean, the fact that Krishna loves us unconditionally is humbling. No, if someone loves us and we did nothing about it and the person's loving us, it's like humbling. But we have to allow ourselves to. I mean, the price to pay to feel that, because everyone is being loved by Krishna, but not everyone is being feeling that. No? So in order to feel that, you have to acknowledge I'm receiving that and I did nothing about it. So that's kind of shattering to the ego, which is always about deserving, earning. So you have to allow that ego death. That's a price to pay, so to say, because it's very humbling. Like, it's humiliating to the false ego that you are loved fully without doing anything about it. It's beautifully and glorious, but to the false ego feels like a type of death. So as I was saying, that's kind of the price to pay. We have to be willing to go through that to really enter into that experience of unconditional love of Krishna. Yeah. Okay, thank you so much to all of you for your presence, questions, contributions throughout the sharing. And yeah, next meeting will be tomorrow at Trivikrana's place in the evening. We will be continuing with the second line of the third verse of Chikshastakam. Taror api sahishrana or tarori va sahishrana in some versions. Be as enduring as the ancient tree. So see you tomorrow for that one. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Sikshastakam ki jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Premananda ki jai, Vanchakalpataru vishtayam, Trusindhu vye vachapti tanam, Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo namo namo.